This is the fifth day of this December 1976 session. We will resume in the Mumong Khan with case number 17. The title is The National Teacher Calls Three Times. The case reads, The national teacher called to his attendant three times, and the attendant answered three times. The national teacher said, I thought I had transgressed against you, but you too have transgressed against me. Then we have Mumon's commentary. The national teacher called three times, and his tongue dropped to the ground. The attendant answered three times, and gave out a corresponding glory. The national teacher, getting old and feeling lonely, pushed the cow's head down to the grass to feed her. The attendant would have none of it. Even delicious food cannot attract a full stomach. Now tell me, how did they transgress? And then this has a kind of an addendum here, a verse that's added. When the nation is at peace, men of talent are respected. When the family is well off, the children maintain their status. And then Mumon's verse. He must carry a holeless iron kang. And his descendants, too, can have no rest. If you want to support the gate and sustain the house, you must climb a mountain of swords with bare feet. It's not very much known about this national teacher or teacher to the nation, perhaps we can say. He's called Etchu. And he'd studied, practiced under the fifth patriarch and also under the sixth patriarch, whose successor he became. And then we're told that for 40 years he lived a secluded life on a mountain, while his reputation as a great master spread. And then in the year 759, he moved to the capital at the imperial order. And for 16 years, he was teacher to the emperor. In fact, to two emperors. And was given the title of teacher to the nation. And he's said to have been well over 100 years when he died in the year 775. Which puts him into the Great Tang period. There's one mondo involving Etchu here, and that is that one time a government officer asked Etchu, when you stayed on Mount so-and-so for years, what kind of training did you have? The master called up a young boy attendant and, patting him on his head, said, If you are this, directly say you are this. If you are that, straightaway say you are that. Don't be deceived by people at any time. Sounds very much like the koan. The case in this particular koan. Notice that don't be deceived by people at any time. You'd think it would be don't deceive people. This kind of directness and forthrightness is very much admired in Zen, even though this Etchu was said to have been a very gentle and open person, he was also a very forthright person. This reminds one also of Confucius's statement. If you know, say you know. If you don't know, say you don't know. Well, Let us come back to the koan. The national teacher called to his attendant three times, and the attendant answered three times. Well, this national teacher, of course, is a title that is given. In this case, it was conferred on him by the emperor. And his attendant, in Japanese, although the koan doesn't give his name, in Japanese he's called Oshin. And he succeeded his master Echu, and he became the abbot of Tangen Monastery. Again, Tangen is the Japanese word for some Chinese monastery. Now, the word attendant, of course, in English has a rather low-down meaning somehow. We think of an attendant as being very much close to a servant. But in Zen, attendants were selected on the basis of their fine, outstanding qualities. Many attendants became masters, became roshis. Out of that roshi's attendant for many years was Tangen Roshi, who now is Tangen Roshi. It might be interesting to point out in this connection that when he was the attendant to Harada Roshi, he lived in very straitened quarters. There had been, just before my coming to Hoshinji, there had been a big typhoon which had hit this town of Obama. And the monastery had been badly hit, but fortunately a few people were just slightly hurt. But Harada Roshi's small house that he was living, perhaps about 500 yards from the monastery, had been completely demolished, and he went to live in the main temple, which was not too big in any case. And the assistant Roshi was also living in the temple, and it made things very crowded. Tangen had this three-mat room, a mat is 3 by 6 feet. And three of these mats, really a tiny room, really. And he waited on the Roshi. And very often, of course, Harada Roshi was quite old at the time, and Harada Roshi's, sort of secretary, factotum, very often would use clappers to call Tangen. On behalf of the Roshi, of course. And it became very interesting to watch. Very often Tangen would be over in the room that I was staying in, which was on quite a way across from where his own room was. And somehow this woman was a little envious of the time that Tangen was spending with me, because Tangen understood English and she understood some English. And there was a kind of a rivalry between them as to who would be instructing me on behalf of the Roshi. And so almost invariably, as soon as Tangen would come over and talk with me about one thing or another, bing, his clappers would come. And I noticed he never got angry. Sometimes he made a kind of a wry face. But he always would respond very quickly. It was too far a distance for him to shout, and you never shout in a monastery. Of course, it's disturbing, that kind of thing. The same thing is true in the center. Sometimes she would sing out, contrary to that rule, Tangen, 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 when he wouldn't hear, or sometimes he would pretend not to hear, when it got too bad. And so, of course, the Roshi selected him because he was such a superior monk. And he was also his Dharma child. Tangen had adopted the Roshi's name, Harada. So, attendants, and there were Roshis, of course, in the old days, especially in large monasteries, the Roshi had about four or five attendants. There'll be one attendant for the bath, another for meals, another for meeting people, another for writing things, keeping his records, and another might be a kind of a secretary sort of person. And always the attendant was a very superior, well-trained person. And very often, almost invariably, they would be enlightened people to one degree or another. So we mustn't think of an attendant as being a kind of a servant, a person of inferior rank with very little or no attainment. Then it continues. The national teacher said, "I thought I had transgressed against you, but you too have transgressed against me." What does this mean, transgression? Dzogchen calls to the attendant. Is that a transgression? In what sense can that be called a transgression? And if the attendant answers promptly, what kind of a transgression can that be called? In this case here, this Ocean, the attendant, as we said, he was undoubtedly an enlightened person. Undoubtedly, whenever the Doshi would call, this master would call this Ocean, there was a quick response. "Attendant, attendant, yes, sir, yes, sir." Or he might be calling Ocean, "Yes, sir, Ocean, yes, sir." Well, usually attendants, their quarters are very close to the Doshis. And usually there's just one calling. Here it says he called three times. And three times, Ocean, the attendant, responded. Why was it necessary to call him three times? Why wasn't once enough? Is this the transgression? Calling him three times? And if it was, why is the attendant answering three times a transgression? Suppose that the Roshi had called three times and the attendant had only answered once. Or that the Roshi had called once and the attendant had answered three times. Wouldn't that have been very queer? Would that be a transgression? And who's transgressing against whom? We begin to see that there's more to this koan than meets the eye and the ear. Actually, Hakuin lists this koan as one of the eight most difficult koans in the Mumonkan. There's an interesting comment on, in fact, there are two comments on this, by Zen masters, on this koan. One is by this Zen master Hogen, his Japanese name. A monk once asked him, "What is the meaning of the national teacher calling the attendant?" And Hogen said, "Ask me some other time." Is Hogen answering his question? If so, in what way? We must ponder, or tsen-sen, as the Chinese say, this kind of an answer of Hogen. There's another one by where a monk asked Joshu, What is the meaning of the national teacher's calling to his attendant? And Joshua replied, it is like a man writing characters in darkness. Characters may not be formed, yet traces have already been left. Where are the traces in this calling? Very often when we write in the dark, it's illegible. In calling, very often, our calling is illegible to people. That's because we do not call no-mindedly. We do not call, so to say, honestly. We do not call sweetly. There's a line of English poetry which goes somewhere, something like, I hear a voice, in the distance I hear a voice sweetly calling, or I hear a voice sweetly calling. How many sweetly call? What does it mean to sweetly call? In Zen, this means calling no-mindedly, having no resentments, having no irritation, either in the calling or in the responding. Very often husbands and wives, when they call to each other, there's some kind of a resentment. A husband, if he's reading a paper, resents being interrupted, and his answer is anything but a sweet reply. Or perhaps the wife is irritated or impatient, and her calling is anything but sweet. Calling children, or calling anybody. Now, how many people really call? They either shout or they grunt. Here between these two, there was this perfect response, like two mirrors reflecting each other. No gaps between them. But above all, not only no gaps, but they are, so to say, on the same note. The note of no-mindedness. One cannot call no-mindedly, so long as there's anything in the mind. If there are evaluations or judgments, or if one is occupied with other kinds of things when one calls, this is not no-minded. This is a full-minded calling. And there's always something lacking. There's always a distance. And this distance, inevitably, to one degree or another, leaves a residue. It is this pure calling where one transcends the calling. There is no awareness of one calling, hardly any awareness of the answering. We are trying to develop in Zen. This is what Zen training is all about. How do we call Mu? We call it in a kind of a frantic sort of way. Or do we call it no-mindedly? No-mindedly means that there is no awareness of our self-calling, ourself as a subject standing against Mu as an object. Call Mu answers. You call Mu answers. It's like in the old days you'd see two blacksmiths working over an anvil. One strikes, the other chimes in. The other strikes and the other chimes in. There's perfect unison. There's perfect rhythm. And after a while, there's no awareness of each other. Be able to call, to be able to speak, to be able to see things. But this kind of mind, this mind of what we may call oneness, not two-ness. And of course without any notions of this is good or this is bad. And above all, without any evaluations and judgments. This is so hard. But unless we train ourselves in Zen in this way, our Zen is very deficient. course, in one sense, any kind of calling. Any kind of naming is missing the mark. To call a thing, whether a person giving a person a name or giving a thing a name, this is already sullying the thing. This is dirtying it. Lao Tzu has a saying, the real person is nameless, egoless, personless. We forget that when we give people names, this is just a convenience. When we call objects by names, this is also just a convenience. This is not telling us what the object is. The real name of the person is nameless. One philosopher said, to speak of God, when I speak of God, it is not God of whom I speak. There is an interesting dialogue which is quoted in Japan, very often in Zen. Involves us a very famous patriot called Kusunoki Masashige. Every Japanese schoolboy heard about him. It's something like American schoolboy. Every American schoolboy has heard of Nathan Hale. He was a kind of a Nathan Hale. And one time he was on a trip, and he happened to be traveling with a Zen monk, or happened to meet a Zen monk. And in the course of their conversation, Masashige asked him, tell me, what is the secret of Zen? And the monk asked, what is your name, please? My name is Kusunoki Masashige. O Masashige, the monk called out. And when Masashige replied, yes, the monk asked, is there any secret here? And it said that this so impressed Masashige that he began to study Zen very seriously. When there are no secrets, when there are no secrets between two people, which means when there are no resentments, when there's perfect understanding and harmony, they're calling, they're naming each other. Is without any kind of inner meaning. It is a no-minded kind of calling. Now let us get to the Mumon's commentary. The national teacher called three times, and his tongue dropped to the ground. The attendant, answering three times, answered with a corresponding glory. This expression, tongue dropped to the ground, means that his tongue melted away. Speaking was really a no speaking. There's a koan in Zen that many of you have worked on. How do you speak without opening your mouth? For Zen people, this is not difficult. How do you walk without your feet? The national teacher was getting old and feeling lonely, and he pushed the cow's head down to the grass to feed her. What does that refer to? We have in the previous line where the attendant gives out with a corresponding glory. Here Mumon seems to be praising the attendant and rather scolding Echu. He's saying that the attendant, in fact, doesn't yield one single bit to his teacher. His light is just as bright as his teacher's. But what does Mumon mean when he says, holding a cow's head down and trying to feed her? Here we come also to the crux, to the nub of the corn. In what sense can we speak of a cow whose head, who is the cow here, and whose head is being pushed down? What does it mean when he says that she is already full? Well, it doesn't say that here, but it says, yes, the attendant would not simply accept it. Even delicious food cannot attract a full stomach. What is a delicious food here? And what does a full stomach mean? These are points that have to be probed in working on this to understand Mumon's commentary. In a sense, we all have eaten a long time ago. And to be forced after your stomach is full to be given a delicious dessert doesn't attract one. What is the delicious dessert that is being offered here? And then Mumon ends up by saying, now tell me, how did they transgress? Here we find that this is really to all Zen trainees that this is being addressed to. To really understand the deepest import of this takes a great deal of training and realization. And this verse, this little verse of Mumon's, when the nation is at peace, men of talent are respected. When the family is well off, the children maintain their status. People have enough to eat. When there is harmony within oneself and inside and outside oneself, and of course the harmony inside oneself creates the harmony outside oneself, it is not difficult to practice. That is to say, to find when there's stability in a country, to develop oneself to the fullest is a lot easier than when there's a great deal of instability. Very often people think it's the other way around. But we've seen in other countries, notably in China, how Buddhism was was at various times literally destroyed by persecutions. But because Zen still had a vitality, it was able to rally. It's very important to understand that in our own country here, we still have a great deal of freedom. This is why so many spiritual traditions are flourishing here, while they're dying in their own countries, which are being taken over gradually by dictatorial governments. In the deeper sense, our own true nature, is it really subject to transgression and non-transgression? Satori, ignorance, it's a kind of a dualism that one can get caught into, as much as one can get caught up with anything. These days there's so much talk about enlightenment, it's sickening. People who advertise openly, brazenly, in 3 days people can come to Kensho. And yet there's a mistake that can be made on the other side, and that is the other side of, as was emphasized earlier, this one-sided Zen of feeling that one is whole and complete, the sutras say so, the masters confirm it, and therefore there's nothing to do. But just note that the willow is red and the pine is green. Then we have Mumon's verse, an iron collar with no hole. He has to wear it. It's no easy matter. Or, let's see, we have a different translation here. He must carry a holeless iron cane, and his descendants too can have no rest. If you want to support the gate and sustain the house, you must climb a mountain of swords with bare feet. A holeless iron cane, of course, is a stock that criminals, felons, were had to wear. It would be bad enough, it's bad enough to wear a wooden one, but an iron one with a hole is bad enough. But an iron one without a hole is just inconceivable. Various interpretations of this phrase. To come to full enlightenment is no easy matter. In a sense, then, training. At least in the beginning, when one seriously embarks on Zen training, one very often feels as though one is wearing an iron cane without a hole. Certainly Zen will never be for the lazy, the self-indulgent, the weak-willed. In Japan it's said that a person who practices Zen is a man of valor. And a woman too, of course. Now this thing here, this and his descendants too can have no rest. Here there are various interpretations to this. We can certainly say that anybody who undertakes Zen training seriously is going to affect everyone around him. Of course, immediately his own family and his friends, his business acquaintances. And very often, a husband or a wife of somebody who's practicing Zen and isn't practicing himself or herself feels that he or she is wearing the iron stock instead of the person who's practicing. I remember years ago in Japan being with a certain person We'd attended a session together. This person was really seriously involved in working on himself. But he didn't have very much opportunity to attend sessions. And his striving and the frustrations that it produced in him made him a very irritable person. And a good deal of his irritation sprung from the fact that his wife wouldn't take up Zen training. At that point, he certainly didn't see that one of the reasons that she didn't was because of his own irritation and lack of harmony and everything that he said Zen training brings. And this is a very common kind of thing. One time we came home from a session. I happened to go back to his home with him. I was invited. His wife made what seemed to be a very good spread, had some chicken and did her best. It was all inappropriate in a sense, but there was a good deal of goodwill behind it. And he got so mad at her and just took the thing and just tipped the thing right over, right into her lap there, with great anger. This happens a great deal with people who are training in Zen, particularly in the beginning. Because we haven't said anything about the kids yet. The kids too have to wear a cane. One kind or another, they feel themselves marked kids. They don't go to church with other kids and they can't talk about going to church or Sunday school. All they can talk about is their father maybe going to Doksa or going to Seshin or going to the Zen center, which nobody understands about. The sins of the father, so to say, are passed on to the children. If you want to support the gate and sustain the house, you must climb a mountain of swords with bare feet. This too is susceptible of many interpretations. How does one truly support the house of Buddhism? Anybody who's practicing Zen certainly has an obligation to support the house of Buddhism. How do you best support that house? Certainly nobody will disagree. One has to develop oneself to the fullest. What does it mean to climb a mountain of swords with bare feet? If you've ever watched a person in a sideshow or somewhere else walk on swords, I remember seeing this quite a number of times as a boy in the sideshows of circuses. One is fascinated how as they walk, it seems to be getting easier and easier, and they go into all kinds of motions indicating that they have absolutely no pain and no restraint toward the end of this walking over these swords. And this is a good deal like practices. In the beginning it feels like a mountain of swords that one is climbing with one's bare feet. But it does become easier, and pretty soon one begins to discover that this bareness is our real nature. The more we're able to bear ourselves of all preconceptions, of all notions of how things need to be done, how people should act, and are able to approach things in this pure, bare condition, our life becomes freer and freer, and happier and happier. And we discover that the top of the mountain is no different from the bottom, and the bottom is no different from the top. And there wasn't really a mountain there. our true nature, is bare of all defilements. Just no-minded unity with life, with people. There's always a sweet voice calling. Very often we think that if our life is going very well, this is very good. Using these words in their common meaning. And if we're facing a lot of adversity, things are very bad. Haku Noshi used to say, there's far more danger to a person when his life is going well than when people are being unkind to him or putting him down. And the reason is that when people are critical of one, they're saying unkind things, there's a chance to learn something from it and to polish oneself, to see these imperfections and to try to improve. And of course this relates especially to practice and training. On the other hand, if one has a very comfortable, respected position in the community or in a certain area, there's a great danger that one will become conceited, even to the point of arrogance. There's very little chance for development. And who can ever say really what is adversity and what are favorable conditions? In this connection, it may be interesting to mention something that happened concerning the center. We happened to learn that there was a large Buddha for sale by an old large Buddha for sale. Two of our members had seen this Buddha 4 or 5 months ago, and for some reason had neglected to say anything about it to anyone here at 57 Arnold Park. And then eventually the word got here that there was such a Buddha for sale, and when we called up to inquire about it, it had been sold only 4 or 5 days before. And one of the persons out of town who was involved in this was sent a short note just pointing this out. Needless to say, the person felt very bad. Well, what happened? Somehow forces were set in motion. And the next thing we know, someone called up and said that there was a beautiful old 10th century Chinese Buddha that a friend, an elderly couple had, and there was a good chance that they might want to contribute it to the center, and that word would come back in less than a week whether they would contribute it or not. And there was talk between me and this person, the intermediary, and then word came back, yes, they would contribute it to the Zen center. It was a quick case where seemingly unfavorable circumstances turned out to be very favorable. Same way you might say you want to catch a train very badly, a plane rather, very badly, and you miss it. You're going on a vacation, perhaps it's the only plane that you could get in, one feels badly. Then what happens? The plane goes down and it crashes and everybody's killed. What seemed like an unfavorable circumstance turns out to be a blessing. And so, especially in our Zen training, not to dwell, not to allow our minds to fix itself on any of the circumstances that happen to us in life. We take them, the favorable and the unfavorable. We go through them the best we can, without dwelling on them, without having remorse, without feeling that we've been cheated. This is really climbing a mountain of swords with bare feet. Bare of all notions of what is favorable or unfavorable. Now let us say something about the Sesshin. So far, the Sesshin has had a rather checkered career. It's been sort of going up and going down. Hasn't yet fixed itself in an upward course. A good deal of the responsibility for this lies with me. Having allowed myself to become ill and depriving people of Dokusan, perhaps in other ways not being as effective as it might have been possible in other circumstances. There's been a certain lowering of the tone of the Sesshin, and for this I'm very sorry. However, we still have 2.5 days remaining. These 2 days are very vital. Sesshin can very easily take a complete about-face. Very often there's a tendency for people to rely too much on a teacher, to feel that without a teacher one can't do anything. This is a mistake. A teacher can, too, he can inspire, encourage. But in the end, and of course this is also true of the monitors, work very hard in the course of a Sesshin to do the same thing. But in the end, the effort must come from each one. The need to find out who and what we are, this resides in each one of us. We can't hope to get this kind of help from anybody, teacher, monitors, or anyone else. Our own determination. To come to Kensho, this is what counts. In Dokusan, people are hearing this over and over again. We've talked about many things in a few, in the encouragement talks by the monitors and myself. We've talked about faith, the believing mind, and other things. Believing mind is the inherent possession of each one. It isn't a matter of trying to even bring it up into consciousness. It's a matter of giving it faith and credence. Of acknowledging what we know is true, what cannot be false. And that is that we all have this. This mind. Sesshin, more than any other activity, is a means of bringing out this faith mind. Even when one has no self-conscious intention or ability, seeming inability to bring it out, the whole effort of the Sesshin will bring it out, inevitably. That is to say, the collective effort of the Sesshin. And people who haven't yet got through their first koan must remember that there are present in this Sesshin, as in every Sesshin, a number of people who have already gotten through. And their help is always, always evident. What this means is that no one need feel inadequate. Beginning of the Sesshin, we talked about the fact that since this was a Rohatsu Sesshin, that all through the Mahayana countries, this whole month, there would be Sesshins like this one, more or less. There would be the same kind of striving. That this was a great help, not to mention this help of the responsive communion between Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and ourselves. which cannot but, in the Rohatsu Seshin, have a greater effectiveness than any other time. Once more, the Seshin is now really beginning. My own health is much better. And together with each one of you, I will work very hard and let each one of you do the same.